Lyndall Gordon is a senior research fellow at Oxford and the author of numerous biographies, including Lives Like Loaded Guns, Emily Dickinson and Her Family's Feuds. This is Lyndall Gordon. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank.
Good.
Okay. I'm here with Lyndall Gordon. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Duncan.
So you wrote a book about Emily Dickinson, and the title is Lives Like Loaded Guns, which is, of course, a quote from one of her poems. But why did you choose that for the title here?
Well, I first was going to write a straightforward autobiography, really challenging the myth, as Emily Dickinson was called in her time. But as I began to, at the beginning of a biography, I often ask myself, what story do you want to tell? And the more I thought about it, I wanted to tell the story of approach the life through the feud that followed her death. Although that, of course, that poem was written, you know, during her lifetime, it was about, I think, art and mortal life. So there is a kind of gun, which is her art, going off. And one can imagine that the volcanic explosive energy of Dickinson's art, but it's in the hands of a master. The master of the gun is the mortal life, so that she is the art is going to go on beyond the mortal life. So that's the deep meaning of that poem, I thought it was really very playful, her sense of her art as a kind of gun. But at the same time, it was appropriate to my sense that she would be appropriated by people after her death, after, as she understood, she was going to last forever. She was obsessed with, in a good way, I mean, she had a vision of her immortality, and that word resonates through her poems. She won't be able to control what will happen to those feuding forces that will try to control her. Her art, who will feel they want to possess her. I don't think, perhaps she didn't know that was going to happen. But anyway, that was the story I wanted to tell, since I wanted to write about the myth, the legend of Emily Dickinson, and it's been extremely powerful, that very sentimental image of somebody who was fragile, living in her room, cutting herself off from the world, you know, exquisitely well-mannered, and restrained and modest, but I felt that sentimental story was not really viable any longer, and it was battered back and forth between the people who owned her manuscripts. So I was going to approach who she was through the two camps that tried to possess her. And they're actually virulent. And it was more virulent than I expected once I began to look at the papers.
How so?
Well, I began looking at the breakup of the Dickinson family, an extremely proper, very well-bred New England family, going back to the Puritan period. Something happened that was absolutely unexpected. I started with not Emily Dickinson, but her brother, Austin Dickinson, and how he was a man of the utmost religious propriety. You wouldn't have, looking at his photograph, which is there in the book, you wouldn't have expected him to undertake the folly of falling in love in middle age and having a mistress, but that's what happened. And so there's somebody making an incursion into Amherst from Washington, D.C., a young faculty wife who makes a beeline for him, really. And it's hard to tell the whole story, but I began with that adulterous relationship that broke up the family, and so that the initial guns, if you like, were in the hands of Austin Dickinson's distraught wife, Susan Dickinson, who was Emily Dickinson's closest friend. And they were friends from girlhood. And Emily Dickinson was sending more poems next door to Susan Dickinson. They lived next door, than to anyone else. And so this very tricky situation in Emily Dickinson's lifetime, and I've tried to deal with it in the course of the book, reading Emily Dickinson's many letters to Susan, and also to the newcomer, Mabel Loomis Todd, who is having an affair with Susan's husband. And so one sees the beginning of this feud in the lifetime of the principals. And then it descends through the generations. What was surprising to me, Duncan, was after finishing this book in 2010, I was invited by the curator of the Dickinson Homestead to give a talk in Amherst. I think it was at Amherst College. I can't remember exactly. It was quite a big hall one evening. And what became apparent, to my surprise, was that the feud continued. It was there, live, in that hall. Even one of the trustees of the homestead sort of apologized to me afterwards for the conduct of one of the other trustees. They were clearly on opposite sides in the feud. And so one of the trustees didn't like my challenging the myth. And so it became very personal. I don't remember that as a bad evening. It was just very stimulating and in a way exciting to see that how hot the feud still was. Generations later.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, I haven't sort of fought this or encountered it. I've let it go 10 years ago. I've written other books, but a book has come out not too long ago, maybe 3 or so years ago, on one side of the feud. So it's still going. What happened is that I was asked to review that book by the New York Times and also by The Spectator in London, and I decided not to because I don't want to engage in the feud myself. I had said what I wanted to in this book. But I think it's still, to judge by what I learned, I didn't read the book. Again, I wanted to just keep out of it. But what I read in various reviews suggested that, you know, it was put out by one side of the feud. So that it was really the, one side is, and that's been a very prominent, has been on the side of the adulterous lovers, rather surprisingly, because, you know, I find it surprising that one side can make a case for the adulterous lovers without apparently lending themselves to the other side. My idea was to deal with both sides as empathically as I could.
Right.
So that's the picture of something that is going on. And I don't know if I'm expanding too much, but 10 years ago, there was a Dickinson meeting actually here where I am in Oxford. And that summer, August 2010, I think it was, the idea was to look at Dickinson's ties with Europe. And I was asked to do that was the year the book came out, and I was asked to do the keynote talk in the evening. I decided to talk about a very totally, I wanted to get completely away from the feud and talk about a subject that was dear to my heart, which was the influence of the Brontes on Emily Dickinson, who she thought Emily Bronte was gigantic. That was her word. And it was an innocuous talk. And yet by that stage, the book was out. And there was a lot of hostility. Not a single person said they liked that talk, although it's customary, you know, to be friendly. I think that meeting was attended by academics, American academics, and I think a lot of the academics were in the traditional camp, which is the pro-adulterous couple camp, because that was the one where the major previous biography that came out in 1974, that was the line there. And I think that came to be the settled view in academe. So I didn't realize that even at that meeting, there would be representatives of the feud. That, in other words, it jumped from a family feud into
almost
a much wider spread feud. Yeah. So I was continually surprised. Now, I could say here in England, the book was published separately by Virago here in England, part of English Little Brown. And it was completely different. In America, I had some very good reviews and very understanding ones. And then there were some challenges that came from people who wanted to stick by the legend and the adulterous couple side in the feud. So they were rubbed up the wrong way because they had published you know, they'd been in print saying something different. In England, it was completely all sweetness and light. I mean, I felt that Emily Dickinson's reputation was at that moment hugely expanding in England. I talked at lots of literary festivals to audiences who were encountering Emily Dickinson, perhaps for the first time. They were thrilled by the poems that were quoted. I did sessions with a young actress who read the poems. We did a duo act together. And I mean, I can tell you about one session at that was extraordinary in Bath. But I felt that in England, there was no sense of the feud at all. They were completely, the readership was completely open to hearing both sides of the feud and picking up in a very accepting way, my sense that Emily Dickinson was a volcanic character. Of course, she had her gardening and domestic side and her gift-giving side. I don't mean to make her, you know, to be reductive, but I felt that she's often talking about earthquakes, volcanoes, and buckled lips of the crater, and that we aren't seeing the real Emily Dickinson unless we take in the tremendous firepower of her poems.
Question.
So I would say in England, people were very ready to embrace that very sassy, strong poet.
And you mention in your book that she was perhaps epileptic. Is that what evidence do we have for that? And does that play into that volcanic quality?
Yes. Well, that's a good question. I want to say first and foremost that there's no way to prove a historical illness. You know, I was thinking as I was writing about, the idea came to me reading her poems, but I know that it has to remain a guess. What I decided to do in one or two chapters only out of 18 chapters, so it was a relatively small fragment of the book, was to put down the circumstantial evidence for her being secluded, not for a sentimental reason because she was in love with one man or another, but really because she was ill. And it was what really struck me was, I mean, when I began looking at poems, I saw a great deal that of evidence of spasmodic lines, "I'll fit for you." There were lots of telling at slant references to something she couldn't talk about publicly. But it was the secrecy that really, I think, led me to think there's an illness here, and that it's an illness that is, in her time, shaming to the public. It's something in a woman that has to be kept quiet. So, and it's a long-term illness, but it's not an illness you die of straight away. So all the circumstantial evidence I packed together in one chapter five, "The Snarl in the Brain." I'll read you one quatrain of a poem. "I felt a cleaving in my mind as if my brain had split. I tried to match it seam by seam, but could not make them fit." So that was one quatrain. Another one is, "My loss by sickness, was it loss or that ethereal gain one earns by measuring the grave, then measuring the sun?" I remember looking up Dostoevsky's account of epilepsy in The Idiot. It was extraordinarily close. But I've got all the detail in that chapter, and I don't want to go into, you know, detail here. Just to say that the more I looked into it, the more plausible it seemed to me. But I said, at the outset, if you're talking about sickness that happened, you know, in a long time ago, one has to be ultra cautious. I quoted words from a biography of that time. It was a biography by Mark Bostridge of Florence Nightingale, and he had a theory of why Florence Nightingale, after she came back from the Crimea, was incommunicado, why she was a semi-invalid. It enabled her to do a lot of work. Emily Dickinson talks about loss and gain. And I think there was gain in being freed by seclusion to do what she wanted with her life, which was to write poetry. And Florence Nightingale was freed to create a nursing service in England and reform war, the treatment of illness in wartime, and they both were able to fulfill a great mission. On the other hand, both suffered. And Mark Bostridge says, I mean, this is a plausible account of a real illness. She wasn't faking it, that she was incommunicado. But I can't absolutely prove it. And the same thing with Emily Dickinson. When I began looking into the family, I saw that there is a genetic element in epilepsy, and there were turned out to be, what I hadn't realized at the outset, two people in the family living very close to the homestead who were having seizures. Her nephew Ned next door, and another member of the family called Cousin Sabina, who had to be brought home from his job in Tennessee when he began to have seizures. he had a very dear slave in Tennessee whom he taught to read and write, who undertook the hugely long, arduous journey with a sick man back from Tennessee to his mother's house in Amherst. So there were all kinds of corroborations. I also looked up the drugs that Emily Dickinson was taking. I found in Amherst in the library that there was a record of the drugstore, of what was being ordered. And that was fascinating, trying to work out, you know, it wasn't a treatable illness. Only in 1912 was epilepsy controllable. So that it would have been very difficult to leave the house. What I found out is that a seizure happens with very little warning, only about a minute's warning. And there's a kind of aura beforehand. So it would explain why she was so chary of being in company. And say when her father, as a trustee at Amherst, would have a big party in the garden at the time of commencement, she would just appear, walk swiftly through the crowd and disappear. It would have been trying for her in case, you know, something went wrong. So the drugs were quite interesting too. They did tally with epilepsy. And then another thing that was to me very suggestive was that at the age of 20, in 1851, she consulted a very eminent Boston physician. I mean, he was so eminent and in his retirement that he only saw very difficult cases. His name was Jackson, and people came from all over New England to consult him. In his best known book, I found a chapter on epilepsy. I went to the medical history library at Harvard. It was fascinating to look at his papers, at his methods with patients. If he found somebody had an incurable illness, as epilepsy would have been, he was inspiring to the patient. He would suggest a way of life that would be congenial to them. And he was very empathic with patients, very different from doctors nowadays who have, you know, a set amount of time to see people. He gave an hour to each patient taking a history. I could tell you lots more about that Dr. Jackson. He was remarkable. And I think he wouldn't have seen her if she hadn't had something very seriously wrong at age 20. And that I think her father, who was actually a very dour New Englander, Emily Dickinson was amused when she read Henry James's The Europeans, which is set in rural New England, because there's a marvelous character, Mr. Wentworth, who she thought him an absolute replica of her austere, very religious father. But he was actually very supportive of her, and she was allowed to do things that weren't usual for women in New England at that time. I mean, I think even very well-bred, well-to-do New Englanders as they were, women were busy in the household. They were hands-on in the kitchen, overseeing. They may have had servants, but they did things. And Emily Dickinson was excused by her father. She thanks him in one of her manuscripts. There's a manuscript, a comment on one of her poems quite early in her poetic career, saying, "I thank you, thanks to her father for allowing her to write from 3 a.m. till midday." So it's even suggestive that she felt more at home in the dark at night. She talks about how she's at her wheel at night. She's using a metaphor of a wheel in the stream, but she's working at night because epileptics suffer from light. It affects their eyes. So I'm going from one thing to another, Duncan, as I'm thinking myself back into all the strands that brought to, that helped me to bring together what I could call circumstantial evidence, but I can't absolutely prove it. One other bit of evidence that was fascinating was to do with in 1865. She'd had a marvelously fertile period in the early 1860s when she wrote the bulk of her great poems. And then in 1865, she went and spent about almost 2 years in Boston for treatment for her eyes. Now, she never wore spectacles. There seemed to be nothing actually overtly wrong with her eyes. But if she had epilepsy, she would have suffered from light. And what seems to come out of the correspondence of that time was that she was affected by sunlight glancing off snow, and the doctor told her to avoid sunlight. I think light flashing on and off can set off a seizure. So it was a very unhappy time for her to be in Boston. She hated leaving home. And I think that only for a very serious reason would she have stayed in Boston for almost 2 years, having treatment that didn't help. She was convinced very quickly that the treatment wasn't going to help, but for the sake of her family's wishes, she stuck it out. And I think what they were perhaps trying to do, if I'm right, that she had epilepsy, was that they were trying to treat her through a symptom, through one of the initiating prompts for a seizure, which would have been, you know, flashes of light, sunlight. But all this, it was actually curious to me at that rather hostile academic meeting in Oxford in 2010. I went to listen to lots of people who spoke, and there was one young academic who had found something I didn't know. I can't remember the details now, but it was about Emily Dickinson's eyes. And it would have been corroborating evidence of why she had to go to Boston and have this really unhelpful treatment. And the leading person who was against my view of things, who had thought Emily Dickinson had TB, I think, as far as I remember, shut up this young woman. I was actually quite shocked about it. It was like freedom of speech wasn't allowed. So feeling sorry for her, I wrote to her after the end of the meeting. I said to her, actually, I was deeply interested in what in the evidence she brought, and I thought she should write an article about it. And quick as a flash, she emailed back saying, no, I don't want to think about it anymore. It was like she'd been warned off this territory by someone powerful, and she was too young, too much at the outset of her career to take any risk.
Wow, that's unfortunate.
Unfortunate, huh? But it seemed to me draconian, a lack of freedom of speech.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you, speaking of speech, is the fact that Emily Dickinson, you mentioned earlier in this conversation that she had these sort of intimations of immortality, if you will. But at the same time, she didn't really go out of her way to publish a lot of her poems during her life. I mean, I understood that she published a few, but do you think she would...
About six.
Yeah, exactly.
About six or seven. And she had, I think, 1,700 and something poems.
Yeah. So what is the deal with that? Why didn't she publish?
Yes. Well, that's a good question. And I think I want to... Well, you probably know, and I'm sure your listeners know, that she did keep... She was concerned to preserve her poems, that she kept them in fair copies, carefully written out in little booklets. They were discovered in her bureau drawer after her death by her sister Lavinia. So she certainly wanted posthumous She wanted to be read posthumously and expected that. I think that what I tried to say in the book is that she actually, I challenged the idea that she didn't want to be published. I tried to show she was actually in touch with quite a few. She had contact with quite a few leading figures in the publishing world. Above all, one Dr. Holland. She was great friends with Mrs. Holland, who was one of the special kindred spirits Emily Dickinson invited into her life. She wrote a poem, "The Soul Selects Its Own Society, Then Shuts the Door." I thought that was a wonderful two lines. She was highly selective with about whom she spent her time with. She wanted only very congenial people who would be her readers. She was often in touch with Mrs. Holland, and I think she hoped Dr. Holland, who was one of the leading publishers in New York, would read her poems. But he was very old-fashioned, and he just thought only men could produce great works of art, and he thought of Emily Dickinson as sort of fey and shallow. He disparaged her. I think she was just not understood by the leading lights of the publishing world. She had a long correspondence with a more charming man in Boston, Thomas Wentworth Higginson. He was a fine man, actually, and he tried very hard to engage with her. It was her initiative. She sent him her poems, and she said, "Are my poems alive? Do they breathe?" And he, over many years, he tried to understand her poems. I think her letters to him were extremely difficult. She could write very riddling letters to people whom she didn't think would understand her. I think he was rather sweet to her. But he just didn't get it. And he tries to say to her in his first reply, "Your poems are spasmodic."
It's not inaccurate, but...
Well, what he was saying is that she has this experimental punctuation where she had dashes instead of traditional punctuation, and her dashes went in different directions. We don't even know now what those dashes, what the different directions meant. When she's published now, it's a travesty to do it without the dashes, because I think they are very important. It's as though she's pushing the language apart.
Right.
Because she is allowing us as readers to enter into, shall we say, the kind of theorems of experience she sets up. That's how I see her poems, as kind of distilled theorems of experience. And she invites us readers to enter into that and to bring our own life experience into those. I mean, the poems may arise from her personal experience, but in some way she offers something wonderfully distilled. Like there's a poem about perception, which I think you could use for any experience. It's brilliantly distilled. And she plays with grammar. And so people who were very educated and proper in her time would have thought, what is she doing, making a word, instead of writing "is situated," she says "situates." She turns a passive verb into an active verb. But you see, she's saying something when she said perception situates something. She's saying perception, you know, has a willful existence of its own. She's so original, you see. But she was a terrific reader of Shakespeare. She thought you almost need read no other book but Shakespeare. And you see, Shakespeare is playing with grammar all the time. When Shakespeare says "foots it" for dance, he's turning a noun, "foot," into a verb, "foots it." You know, so she got the idea from Shakespeare. She's actually, you know, there's a very legitimate history, but I don't think the sort of leading publishing lights of her time, she didn't expect them to understand her. But I have to say a big but, Duncan, she circulated her manuscripts. And so I think she had an alternative to publication. I said in the book that I counted about 600 recipients of her poems. So she was doing something that was actually more established than print, which was, went back before Gutenberg's invention of print, which was 1475. Before that, people circulated manuscripts, and even after the printing presses were established, there were certain writers who continued to circulate manuscripts for one reason or another. The aristocratic poets of the 16th century, like Sir Philip Sidney, and Spencer, I think they circulated their manuscripts. And Byron, in the early 19th century, being an aristocrat, they weren't interested in the in readers who were just the herd to them. They wanted just to reach the chosen few. And one could say there was an elitism in Emily Dickinson. I don't know if that's the wrong word, but she was interested in her manuscripts reaching the enlightened. By the enlightened, she doesn't mean the educated. She means the people who would have the emotional intelligence to read her and lend themselves to her. So she actually had a big readership of her own choosing, and she was doing something that was an alternative to print. And another way of putting this, Duncan, is that her work is provisional. If you look at her fair copies, she often has alternative words at the bottom of the page for certain words. It's as though she hasn't quite finished with poems in the making, even though she had fair copies. That wasn't print. What print gives to writing is an absolute finality. Do you know what I mean? And whereas if she has written out manuscripts, they're still in the making. And so this idea in the book excited my son-in-law is a musician, and Philip Clark, and he had he did an article at the time, an interview with me at the time the book was published, because his big thing is he's very keen on jazz, and his big thing is improvisation. And he thought Emily Dickinson was an improviser. And there's something jazzy about her rhythm that, you know, appealed to him a lot.
I can see that, definitely.
Can you see that? I'm trying to then both say she was, had, you know, she was in an awkward situation in terms of print in her time, in that she was so experimental that she couldn't expect the, you know, publishers of her time to take her on. And then I did tell the story, but then she also had, which was always so with Emily Dickinson, she also had her own game going. She was circulating manuscripts. So it was loss and gain. I wanted to tell the story also, if I'm not taking up too much of your time.
No, not at all.
I wanted to tell the story of Thomas Niles. He was a leading publisher with Roberts Brothers, a leading press in Boston. It was the kind of press you would naturally have gone to. Louisa May Alcott published Little Women with Roberts Brothers. Now, I think this man, Thomas Niles, was nudged by a friend of Emily Dickinson's about this. There were only three people in Emily Dickinson's lifetime who read her with understanding, and with an understanding that she was a genius. One was the intruder on the family, who's such a big figure in my book, Mabel Loomis Todd. There was also her beloved sister-in-law, Susan Dickinson, who, you know, she writes rare to the rare to her. She felt like she was a soulmate. And then there was another well-known poet, American poet at the time, Helen Hunt Jackson. Now, Helen Hunt Jackson, who we don't remember nowadays, but was very big in the 1870s and 1880s. And she came from Amherst. She knew Emily Dickinson, and Emily Dickinson allowed her to visit, as she knew Emily Dickinson was a genius. And she nudged, with all the authority of her own fame, nudged Niles to have a look at Emily Dickinson's poetry. Now, what I want to just preface what I'm going to say is about Louisa May Alcott's experience. She sent Louisa May Alcott in, was it 1868, Little Women? She sent Niles the first 13 chapters of Little Women, and he just didn't get it. I think he was really hopeless. If he didn't get it, that Little Women is just a marvelous read, and was bound to appeal to, to teenage girls as it appeals to adults. And he was going to turn it down when he gave it to his niece. I don't know how old she was, Lily Elmy. And she laughed and cried. It changed this Niles's mind to see this little girl responding. And he accepted Little Women. So you can tell that he wasn't a person who had, you know, I think that's, he's probably, there are many like him in the literary marketplace in all time, people who don't get it. You know, T.S. Eliot turned down George Orwell. You know, there are numerous stories of people
who just didn't get it.
Well, in Eliot's case, he may have got it partially. He did know Orwell could write, but the politics were different. Orwell was, Eliot was right-wing, and Orwell was, he was basically left-wing, though he was, of course, attacking communism in Animal Farm. It was Animal Farm Eliot turned down for Weber. Mm. So, but I think there are numerous examples of mistakes of that kind, where a great work, you know, a lasting work gets turned down. Now, Emily Dickinson was persuaded by Robert's brothers, by this man Niles. This is the early 1880s, so these are the last years of Emily Dickinson's life. She was in her 50s, and she died in 1886 in her 50s. In 1883, at Niles's request, she sent him three poems. And he kept them a long time. And then he wrote back an icy letter saying, well, thank you for your poems, but I haven't consumed them. I don't know, it was sort of not very nice. And no. I think, Emily Dickinson, Emily Bronte had terrible reviews for Wuthering Heights. I think that made Emily Dickinson feel, empathic towards her. I think that I can't say this in print, but perhaps I can just say it orally. I think it is so terrible to have rejections. It is so disheartening. And I speak as someone who's, I've had a lot of good luck in my life, but I've also had a fair share of rejections. I think it's terribly shattering and disheartening. And I think that if you've written something really great, like Wuthering Heights, or Emily Dickinson's written these really great poems, she sent one of her three poems she sent to Niles was It Sifts from Leaden Sieves. It's about a snow. It's a great poem. I mean, to have these things turned down, I think it's really soul-killing. And I think Emily Dickinson died fairly soon after, and Emily Bronte died really soon after. I mean, I can't say they died because of these rejections,
right?
Because of course Emily Bronte had TB, but one could say disappointment could hasten death. Well, you could lose your heart.
That's one of the things that must have been particularly difficult about that rejection, is if you're someone who's like Emily Dickinson, who's capable of writing that kind of genius poetry, she had to have understood on some level, being able to, you know, a genius recognizes genius, she had to have understood that this is good stuff. And then to be rejected is almost like, wait a second, am I crazy? Like, am I just delusional here? You know what I mean?
Yes. Absolutely. So you see, she had this huge self-confidence. She is writing often in her poems about the flood subject, immortality. It's at her fingertips. She is unlike some religious poets, like, I think of Eliot, or I think of George Herbert in the 17th century. They craved vision. They felt it came to them their visions were very few and far between. They felt, you know, and even John Donne, you know, who said, something like, you know, I smash my fist, you know, unless you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste except you ravish me. He's crying out to God to come to him. You know, they feel so lacking in vision. Whereas Emily Dickinson had it in spades. She just, mine in vision and in vitae, she felt empowered as Emily Bronte did. That was one of the big affinities between them on Emily Dickinson's part, that they both were rich in vision. And I think that she felt huge confidence, both in her visions and in the power of her pen. And then somebody does, as you say, Duncan, comes along, and you have to think, well, am I mad? Nobody wants me after all. You know, have I got it all wrong? Or they're just disheartened. I think rejection's very difficult to bear. And yet, you know, it's part of the world out there. And it's particularly part of, if any of the people who are going to listen to this are writers, it's part of the marketplace right now where, you know, everywhere, it's a matter of making money. So that the kind of rejections I've had is, because I'm already established, they'll say, oh, well, you know, you can write, of course. This is well done, but I don't know how to publish it, which is their way of saying, I don't know how to make money or enough money. So I think it's a much tougher world out there, even tougher than in Emily Dickinson's time when, you know, it was gentlemen who reigned in the marketplace. Now it's global corporations.
Yeah, which, I mean, a gentleman you could perhaps persuade to look at your poems, whereas a global corporation is just a machine for profit.
Yes, it's all about profit. And they're also so scared. You can't help feeling a bit sorry for the rejecting editors, because they're very scared for their jobs. If they don't make money, you know, for the overlords, you know, they'll lose their jobs.
Yeah, that's so tough. With the last question I wanted to ask you is, do you think that she died without seeing like the tremendous success of her work?
Yes.
But do you think that she was a happy person, would you say?
Yes. I think she was not just happy. I think she was, somebody once said to me, she was an ecstatic. There was a woman who gave organized actors' readings at the British Library. She's no longer alive, Josephine Hart. She's terrific. I used to take the train to London to go to those wonderful performances of poetry while I was writing this book on Emily Dickinson. And Josephine Hart said to me once, Emily Dickinson wasn't an ecstatic. And I thought that was the right word. And she uses that word ecstasy in one of her poems. I think that she didn't worry about fame. although she knew she was going to have it, she knew she was going to have immortality. She had the joy of creation, and that was what she lived for.
On that note, Lyndall, thank you very much for your time. This was a pleasure talking to you.
It was a pleasure for me too, Doug.
Thank you to Lyndall Gordon, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.